Hey, I'm Jane Lindholm. I'm the host of Vermont Edition, and I'm just popping in to tell you that this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Every January, Vermont Edition goes on the road for two very different shows. At the beginning of the month, you'll find us at the Vermont State House in Montpelier for the start of the legislature. And at the end of the month, we head to the Champlain Valley Exposition in Essex Junction to do a show from the annual Farm Show, which is where we are today. I won't try to compare the two places, except to say that there's perhaps more overlap than you think. In both instances, we might talk about the working landscape, mental health issues, the price of dairy and milk, what federal trade deals mean for Vermont, and the importance of clear guidance on THC content for things like hemp. But there are also things we talk about here at the Farm Show that we are less likely to discuss at the State House, like the price of the enormous tractor tires on display here, as we did last year, or the importance of a good breeding program for your herd, as we'll discuss at the end of the hour. Earlier today, I poked my head into the area where the FFA, Future Farmers of America, competition is underway. Groups of high schoolers had their heads down, concentrating on the testing they were doing to identify the milk fat content in the dairy samples they had in front of them, or over in the forestry area, what kinds of trees they were looking at wood samples of. I definitely would have failed those tests, but for the students participating, they're working their way toward potentially going to the nationals. We're going to get a sampling of the sounds and voices of the Farm Show today, and let's start with Wendy Wilton. Wendy is State Executive Director for the USDA Farm Service Agency Vermont, and she's with us now. Nice to talk with you again, Wendy. We always seem to meet here at the Farm Show.
I know. Great to see you, Jane.
So let's talk a little bit about trade deals, and maybe the first one we should talk about is the USMCA, the US-Mexico-Canada trade deal. Hasn't fully gone into effect yet, hasn't fully been ratified by all three countries, but what kind of impact is that likely to have on Vermont's ag agency and ag industry?
I think of the two trade deals that are in the news right now, USMCA is most important for Vermont. And that's being signed today by the president, if not already. So it's really kind of historic that we're talking about that today. The importance of it is that for dairy, Canada and Mexico are our largest export markets for U.S. agriculture. That totals about $40 billion in 2018 was the number that I was able to find. And Mexico is the bigger market for us for dairy. So having this trade deal at least executed by the United States, and I think we're waiting for Canada, right? Mexico maybe has already signed it, but I think that's going to be a real boost for agriculture. Of their proximity, their geographical proximity to us. There are zero tariffs with this agreement, which is great. There are new markets for dairy with both countries. And another important aspect of this is that Canada agreed to stop production of its Class 7 and Class 6 milk products, which I think also helped to depress the price.
So is it just having some certainty that is likely to help, or are there specific things in the trade deal that you're looking that you think are going to be most helpful?
Well, I think it's both the certainty and also the fact that, you know, we have opportunities for more trade among the three countries.
So let's talk a little bit about China as well, because certainly that's in the news for a number of reasons. Coronavirus really on the minds of a lot of people, not likely to have a big impact on Vermont's ag sector. But what about trade policies and updated trade deals with China?
Well, I think this is less likely to impact us as opposed to USMCA because China and Asia in general has not been a huge destination, relatively speaking, for U.S. dairy. And when the secretary put out the market facilitation program money, that was also based on how much of an impact that commodity was having with Asia trade, particularly China. And dairy did not get a huge boost from that, although we did see some more money in the second tranche of that, and I can talk about those figures in a minute. But really, the products that were most affected were soybeans, wheat, rice, and pork. So those particular industries, which are not dominant here, we don't have very much of it. We've got a little pork, but it's really local. We're greater beneficiaries of the market facilitation program. So that's something to think about. But there's huge potential in Asia. I think that the Chinese and Asia in general is starting to have a feel for dairy products, like frozen dairy products, those kinds of things.
We've been talking about that for 5 or 10 years now, right?
Yeah.
That the Chinese market is one that U.S. dairy producers and even in Vermont, dairy producers are trying to look at as a potential area for expansion, right?
Yeah. 7 years ago, I went to a Dairy Queen in Kunming, China. So it was interesting. Anyway, and their flavors are a little bit different, but, you know, it did involve some dairy product, probably whey. So whey is the product to watch there because it's a dry milk product that can be exported easily, far distances, and that kind of thing. So out of the $200 billion that we expect to trade with China as a result of this phase one deal, I'm seeing numbers between $50 and $80 billion will be agriculture. But again, Jane, I think it's mostly going to be in those commodities that I mentioned to you. Let's talk about the impact of the market facilitation program that Secretary Perdue put out to really relieve the tariff issue under the negotiations. So in 2019, we expect the final tranche to go out in February, and that should result in payments of about $6 million to Vermont farmers for dairy, corn, and pork, mainly dairy. In 2018, that was $3.2 million. So you can see with the changes that were made in the program, there was a slightly better benefit for dairy. So that was good to see. And what's really good is that what I'm hearing is that that third payment should go out sometime soon. I'm not really sure when. That would complete the cycle, and it's even going out after the trade deal was agreed to. So that's a good thing. That's good news.
There's other money that the USDA provides to Vermont farmers, both in the form of relief and in other ways as well?
Yes. Farm Service Agency provides loans to farmers, but also farm programs. So last year, we provided $10.6 million in direct payments to Vermont farmers, mostly in dairy. It was mostly as a result of the Margin Protection Program for dairy, a price support, and also MFP. This year, for 2019, and we're not quite done yet because there will be that other MFP payment that will come, is what I understand. We're so far, we're at $11.6 million. So we increased that by $1 million. And I think that was really important for Vermont farmers, particularly for dairy. It's mostly dairy money, whether it was dairy or it was in your corn production. So I think that's really important. Our current loan portfolio is about $60 million for direct loans and about $120 million for guaranteed loans. So we do play an important part with Vermont Agricultural Credit Corp and other private sector lenders to agriculture and supporting them that way. And through this tough period, we helped our farmers by refinancing debt and helping them get through this tough period. There's cautious optimism about milk prices.
Oh, good. Well, milk is where we're going next, and dairy. So I'm going to let you go, Wendy, because I know you have other people to talk with while you're here as well. Wendy Wilton is State Executive Director for the USDA Farm Service Agency for Vermont. Wendy, thanks for talking with us again.
Jean, thanks so much.
Always a pleasure to be here at the Farm Show, as Vermont Edition is every year. And we'll turn now to Laura Ginsburg, Agricultural Development Section Chief for the Vermont Agency of Agriculture, Food, and Markets. Laura, it's nice to have you with us today here
thanks,
at the Farm
I'm
Show.
Happy to be here.
So we were just talking with Wendy about dairy and some of the relief programs that the USDA provides. But Wendy's last point was one that's kind of interesting, some cautious optimism for milk prices and that maybe they may be moving up. What are you seeing?
That's right. So we just got the milk forecast a couple days ago for the whole of 2020, and it looks like prices are heading steady into $19 or $20 a hundredweight, which is great news for our dairy farmers.
Great news in the sense that it's better than $17 a hundredweight, but great news in terms of prices in general? I mean, what would we like to be seeing?
I think around 20 works for most farmers in our state. It's definitely above the cost of production for most farms, but whether or not that allows them to put a lot of money back into their savings account and pay off debts that they've acquired over the past 4 or 5 years of really low prices is yet to be seen.
Well, not just that, but I think there are other things and other investments that farmers have been putting off because the milk prices have been so low, and one of them is in how to mitigate runoff or other things that may be leading to pollution. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I'm happy to. We do hear from farmers that they have to put off some projects because they just don't have the money in the bank or they can't borrow anymore and their debt payments are high. So they don't want to take on any more debt. So the higher milk prices will give that little bit of breathing space for farmers to be able to do the projects or repair the equipment that they've been hoping to do for the past few years.
So what about this new report? I think the Ag Agency just came out with a report. It has a lot in it. Anything that you want to highlight for us in the limited time we have in our interview today?
So the Ag Strategic Plan, I think, is what you're referencing. And I did write the dairy brief section of that. And I think there's a lot of optimism in the dairy brief. We also just received the Dairy Innovation Center funds from the USDA. We're one of three national centers. And those ideas combined really allow us to take an innovative look at options outside of solely fixing milk pricing, because that's not something that we can do as a state. And so we need to have a dairy industry that can be successful without relying on the federal government to make prices better. And so these are a lot of proposed ideas for farmers to have options to change production styles or do value-added processing or improve marketing, and just a different way of approaching dairy.
Do you think there's optimism or pessimism overall in the dairy sector?
I think that might depend on the day. I always like to take the perspective that it's better to be optimistic than to be pessimistic, because then you're looking towards a better future. So I feel like there's a lot of energy and enthusiasm in the work that I'm doing, which was captured in the dairy brief and had a lot of energy and feedback from farmers who are excited about looking at new things. But I think it's also really, really hard when consumer feedback is really negative, or milk prices go down, or there's another story about practices on a dairy that are unsavory, that really can pull at the heartstrings of the farmers and make their day go from good to bad pretty quickly.
You know, Laura, one of the things that I think is interesting is we got some stats from you on dairy in Vermont, and I think you told us about 660 dairy farms in the state, mm-hmm. 151 processing plants for fluid milk, cheese, butter, ice cream, yogurt, and powder. A decade ago, there were over 1,000 dairy farms, and we've talked a lot about that over the years in the media and of course, you know, within the communities here in Vermont. But one of the stats that I think is interesting is we keep thinking about and talking about consolidation and fewer farms with more cows, but 80% of the dairy farms in Vermont still have fewer than 200 cows. So we're still looking at an industry with relatively small farms, at least by regular dairy standards in America. And what does that mean for us and how we practice dairy in this state?
That's absolutely correct, that it is unusual for any region in the nation to have such a concentration of small farms. And we're very lucky to have that, because it really positions the state to be able to take advantage of consumer trends that are looking at preferences to small farms, transition to grass-based management systems, and even our big farms by national standards are very, very small. So we really are very well positioned and able to leverage that concentration of smaller farms to be a good thing moving forward for the whole dairy sector in the state.
In our recent VPR Vermont PBS This Land survey, where we talked about rural issues, 72% of the respondents said that the dairy industry is, quote, a very important to Vermont's sense of itself. So as we look at that, I mean, you think moving forward it's going to continue to be a strong part of the Vermont identity, even if we have fewer farms?
I absolutely think so. I think there's so many people that are connected to the industry in so many different ways, and for generations people have been connected to it, that even if there's fewer farms, if we have successful farms, if we have farms that are good caretakers of the land, they're producing amazing products that go around the world that lift up the Vermont name, then dairy will always have a place in this state.
That's Laura Ginsberg, Agricultural Development Section Chief for the Vermont Agency of Agriculture. Thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thanks. It was a pleasure.
We're here at the Farm Show talking with many different people, and let's turn now to Stephanie Smith. And we're talking to Stephanie about hemp. Hemp has been legal to grow in Vermont since 2014 under a USDA-approved pilot project, and the 2018 Farm Bill reclassified hemp as an agricultural product and ignited a lot of interest in the crop here in the state. So there was a huge jump in hemp production in the last growing season. Stephanie Smith is the Chief Policy Enforcement Officer for the Agency of Agriculture, and she's been focused on hemp regulations and hemp markets. Nice to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
So can you talk a little bit about how many people actually did grow hemp in the last growing season? Because we discussed it on the show. It was a big boom in hemp.
Yes. So in 2018, we had 461 registrants within the program, and that included growers and processors. Combined registrants for 2019 was almost 1,300. So, huge jump.
Huge jump. But not all of them had a successful growing season. What do we know about how that panned out?
Yeah, so we did an informal survey at the end of the growing season in November of 2019, and we learned that just under 70%, when they were putting seed in the ground, did not have a contract or have an idea of where their crops were going in the market. And as of November of 2019, we discovered that 50% still didn't know where their crops were growing. So
as
people
of November.
Are, yes.
Wow.
So people are still have it. That doesn't mean it stores if you have good storage. So there's potentially opportunities into 2020 to sell that crop.
But it's difficult if you don't have the capital to sort of float yourself, if you still don't have a place to send your crop and you're not making money
on
it.
That's true. Yes, yes. If you were depending on that for a living, yes.
It was also a tough growing season. I mean, as we remember, at the beginning of the growing season, it was really wet, and we were seeing a lot of people put in hemp pretty late in the season.
Correct. Yeah, there were. It was a really wet spring. Individuals actually discovered that they'd registered acres that they actually couldn't use, and they couldn't get their plants in the ground because the conditions were so wet. So it did kind of prolong the season. People were still harvesting into November, and there are still crops in the ground today that are covered under snow that no one's harvesting.
Ever.
No, hopefully not.
So what do you think that means then for 2020 as we head toward the spring and people are thinking about what to put in the ground and then, you know, what they're going to do with it when they take it out later on when they harvest?
So we think we're going to have a slight reduction in the number of registrants for the 2020 growing season. We also think that it's possible that we'll have those that were successful will expand their acreage. And we might even see more value-added products, so a vertically integrated farm where they're growing, harvesting, and then creating products that they can then sell, as well as potential new infrastructure coming into the state to process, to provide that next step in a value-added marketplace and to get products on the shelves.
Are we seeing that increase in that bottleneck in processing yet?
We do see some interest, but we haven't started registering for 2020. I'll admit the agency has extended all registrations from 2019 until March of this year, and we're putting together a new registration program.
And in the new registration program, there are different tiers of costs, right? Because that's been changing.
Yes. So there are new tiers of costs. If you're growing for personal use and you're growing less than a half acre, it's still $25, and so individuals can still get into the growing at a low cost for themselves. And then it's tiered $100 to $3,000, and that's from a half an acre of cultivation is $100, and then up to over 50 acres would be a $3,000 registration cost. If you're doing indoor cultivation and it's exclusively indoors, if it's 500 square feet or less, it's $1,000, and if it's greater than 500 square feet, it's $2,000.
So it's pretty pricey compared to what it used to be if you're a large-scale grower.
Correct.
And there's no grandfathering in. You can't say, well, last year I only paid $25.
No.
One of the things that we've also been looking at is what the regulations are in terms of THC content. And I understand that there were some hemp growers who had too much THC in their product. So what happened with that?
Yeah, so we actually experienced approximately four individuals or farms that it did test high, and they were required to destroy their crops. It was a self-report. The agency, you know, went and witnessed and had pictures and documented the destruction, and that was great. It was kind of a great relationship to understand that our growers had trust in the agency, as well as the agency having trust in growers.
Probably not so great for the growers.
Not all cases was the entire crop as well. Yes.
And you think they were good faith efforts but the crop you can't always.
Yeah, you can't always predict. Actually, we think it's really important for growers to know where they're getting their seed, so that they can have some assurance. You know, look for the certificate of analysis from the grower for that particular variety of seeds so that you know what you're getting. It's important.
All right. Well, more to come on hemp because this, as we said, is something that's certainly growing in the state. And while we may not see quite as many new growers in the 2020 season as there were in 2019, it's still something that Vermonters and Vermont ag producers are trying to figure out where they stand on and what they might want to grow. Stephanie Smith is the Chief Policy Enforcement Officer for the Agency of Agriculture, Food, and Markets, and she has been focused on Vermont hemp regulations. Stephanie, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
This is Vermont Edition. We are live at the Champlain Valley Expo for the 2020 Vermont Farm Show. There are all kinds of things to see and people to talk to at the farm show, from coffee-flavored maple syrup samples to talking with the Department of Taxes about your taxes to learning more about farm insurance or going back to school or conservation career opportunities. Or maybe you just want to feel the wool samples and from sheep and alpaca, and there's even an angora sample as well. Alongside her husband, Megan Audette runs Cracked an Egg Farm in Brandon. She raises these three breeds of registered sheep, Finn, Cotswold, and Clenforest, and is expecting about 80 lambs this spring. Audette has been keeping sheep since 2006. She's not showing at the farm show, but she stopped by yesterday to learn more about Vermont's sheep, wool, and fiber industries, and about how raising animals for show, as she does on her farm, fits in with Vermont's sheep farmers.
We are basically breeding for quality at our farm. Everybody is registered, so that means you can show them at the fairs, and they're papered like dogs are, so they're purebreds. So showing and for lambs. With that being said, there's a lot of purebred animals out there that aren't very good quality, so we're basically trying to help promote the breed. Two of the breeds that I raise are heritage and endangered breeds. So there's a program called the Livestock Conservancy that is promoting those breeds because they're critically endangered, and so I'm helping promote those two breeds that I have that are critical. And now we're basically just breeding and trying to make really good on the breed.
Sheep farmer Megan Audette of Cracked an Egg Farm in Brandon. Dave Martin is another passionate Vermont sheep farmer, which you might expect given that he's president of the Vermont Sheep and Goat Association. The association has been around for more than a century, founded at a time when sheep farms outnumbered dairies in the state. Martin says the association represents what is now a small but mighty corner of Vermont's agricultural sector, one he sees as critical for keeping Vermonters connected to their food, the land, and a low-impact form of farming.
It's a small industry now. It's like a lot of smaller agricultural enterprises in Vermont.
The Sheep and Goat Association has about 160 members. Most of our members are relatively small growers. They have just a few sheep or goats. I run about 100 ewes. There are some farms in Vermont that raise, you know, 400 and 500 sheep. I sell lamb as my main product. I also have wool. Some of my members really focus on producing a very high quality fiber. And in Vermont, there's a growing number of goat dairies. The last time I checked, there were 44 licensed goat dairies in Vermont. That's rapidly expanding. Compared to farms out west, it's small. But I think it's a part of Vermont agriculture that's important. We are trying to expand it, trying to create an environment in which somebody who has a few acres and some equipment can become involved in the agricultural industry in Vermont. Maybe not make a whole lot of money, but make some money and contribute to the community. Small farmers purchase grain. They purchase grain supplies. They purchase veterinary equipment. They support the local vet. And all that money just stays in the local community. So I think small-scale agriculture in Vermont is important, and it helps people maintain a knowledge and a connection to the land in Vermont, which I think is important, that the public in general understands where their food comes from and where their fiber comes from. I think for most of my Sheep and Goat Association members, for them, climate change is real. I think grass-based farming is a really great way to work on the issue of climate change. My sheep are raised out on pastures all year long. I have a nutrient management plan developed with the Extension Service, and where I'm really aware of the manure that I collect and stack and track the fields I spread it on. And I think the members of the Sheep and Goat Association, I think they're all concerned about water quality and the environment. And I think raising sheep is a way to do that. It's low impact, takes fewer inputs. I don't need hundreds of gallons of diesel fuel to raise my sheep. I do have a tractor and I do burn some diesel fuel, but I don't have to burn a lot. My sheep harvest all their own grass. That's an important goal for small-scale local agriculture, understanding how we are all connected and interconnected and work to support each other and work on keeping the environment clean.
That was Dave Martin, president of the Vermont Sheep and Goat Association. Megan Peake is the director of community relations at Blue Cross Blue Shield Vermont, and she also serves on the board of the Vermont Farm Health and Safety Coalition, and she's here at the farm show today and here with us at VPR's booth. Megan, nice to be with you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
What's your purpose here at the farm show? What are you trying to do?
So we're trying to just make access to healthy resources, taking care of yourself, wellness, preventive care, just be accessible and easy for folks to see how they can take action on keeping themselves well.
So not necessarily access to health insurance through, you know, through the Vermont processes, but other ways of staying healthy? I mean, is that more the focus?
Yeah, we do have, I mean, Blue Cross is here. We also have Vermont Health Connect here to answer people's questions. But really, the purpose of the booth is the coalition, lots of organizations represented, but to give farmers access to resources that can help them stay well. And
What was the impetus behind the Farm Health and Safety Coalition?
So the Farm Health and Safety Coalition came together about 10 years ago after there was some suicides in the dairy industry around on the East Coast, not in Vermont specifically. But there was concern that there were depression and stress issues. There's always challenges with milk prices, and we really wanted to pull a group together to create, it was originally called a task force, to look at that issue and work on it. So the group has continued to work together. The first project we did together was to develop a sort of an EAP for farmers, at first for dairy producers, and then it expanded to all producers. But it's called Farm First, and it's a service that any farmer can call a hotline and talk about a myriad of issues, issues that cause stress like financial issues, health issues, mental health issues. So that was one of our first projects, and then we've continued from there.
Do you think you've seen success?
We have certainly seen success in the number of folks accessing the services. In terms of whether the levels of depression and stress have improved, that's a harder thing to measure. I think that we're seeing a national issue around those concerns for everyone beyond the agricultural community. So I think the issues are still really powerful and out there. But I think that more folks know about the services available to them and are taking action and saying, okay, we can do something about this.
Right. You can't address the root causes. You can't address stress like low milk prices, but you can perhaps address, you know, people's access to things that might help them deal with that stress.
How they manage it,
Other things that you're looking at and working on and trying to create awareness around, I understand Lyme disease is one of them.
Yeah, so Lyme disease has become a huge issue, and the other tick-borne illnesses, which I won't try to pronounce. But we have a lot of great information. Department of Health is participating with us to share that information. We're hearing from farmers that they're actually seeing ticks on cows, which has never really been reported before. The numbers of ticks on deer that are in hunting season, like folks are talking about the ticks kind of raining off them when they hang them up after a hunt. So it's really challenging. There's a lot more exposure, but there are things people can do to protect themselves. So we're providing that. We have little tick kits that teach you how to remove a tick properly and how to watch for any signs of disease.
And then on-farm injuries, another thing that certainly has been a problem for as long as there have been farms and farm equipment, but something that you're focused on this year?
Yes, we actually have the best display we've ever had. We have too many
things. How do you determine whether it's the best display or not?
We like, the more gruesome, the better. No, we just have a really wonderful interactive displays from UVM Extension and NICAM, which is New York. Based organization that covers the region. And they have a wonderful interactive displays about dangers on the farm. We also have folks doing stop the bleed demonstrations, so folks should swing on by. They can learn how to do a tourniquet. You can do a self-applied tourniquet, which I just recently heard a story of a guy in Vermont who did that and was able to drive himself to the hospital and probably saved his own life.
Wow.
So there's a lot of steps people can take to avoid these catastrophic kind of injury that often result in, you know, long-term challenges to continue working on the farm. So a lot around that.
So come for the great display, stay for the injury prevention tips.
And the free massage.
And the free chair massage. Yeah, and if that doesn't get you there. Megan Peake is Director of Community Relations at Blue Cross Blue Shield Vermont and serves on the board of the Vermont Farm Health and Safety Coalition. Thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Welcome back. This is Vermont Edition, live from the 2020 Vermont Farm Show at the Champlain Valley Expo in Essex Junction. People walking by our booth, heading to and fro, looking here at Media Row and all of the stations that are here to try to think about and look at what's happening in Vermont's agricultural sector, as well as people enjoying samples. We had two women who have been watching the show who have been eating ice cream, and that's been really tempting for me to jump across the table and have some of their ice cream. And we're talking with just a few of the people who come to the farm show or work the farm show every year. Now, if you have cattle insemination needs, you might come talk to our next guest at the farm show. Andrew Sutton is the Northeast Technician Supervisor for Premier Select Sires, a farmer-owned co-op with technicians who do on-farm visits providing breeding services in New York and Vermont. Andrew, it's nice to talk with you.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So what might somebody be looking for here at the farm show that they'd want to come and ask you about?
The latest and greatest genetics, I would say.
And what are the latest and greatest in genetics?
It depends what you're looking for, but there's a number of different bulls that we have on the market right now. Between our salesmen and our technicians, there's about, you know, there's many routes that we can get that those bulls to our customers throughout Vermont and the whole country, really.
So if I'm a farmer, what might I be looking for? What are some of the characteristics that might help me differentiate between one bull or another? What might I be breeding for?
It depends what the cow that you're working on, what you want to advance with her overall makeup, genetic makeup. So we can look for more milk in a cow, more fat, more protein. Overall, more value added to your herd with that, using that cow and using that bull.
Can you talk a little bit about Helix, the bull?
So Helix is a bull. He's the number one TPI bull right now. Just
TPI.
Really, really high total production index.
Got it.
So he's rated very high. He's going to add money to your cows. The biggest thing is, you know, when we look at these numbers, we compare them to, you know, to say a barnyard bull somebody's using, they don't know much information about that bull, so they can look at these numbers that we have in our catalogs and look at how the bull might influence that cow, that heifer calf, when she begins to lactate.
What are the costs? If I want to use Helix, what's it going to cost me?
So Helix, he's an economical bull right now for his genetics. I think his list price is about $60.
And what does that mean? $60 gets me what?
Gets you one unit of semen from that bull.
Which could inseminate how many cows?
Just one cow.
Okay, so it's basically $60 per cow that you want to inseminate.
Correct. And he's towards the top of the line. We have bulls that, you know, that range from even, you know, more expensive than him, depending on if they're harder to get, things like that.
What's the range? Like 30 to?
You know, it depends. You can get into, you know, gender selected as well. So, you know, and rare bulls that may have passed away at this point, you know, you could spend hundreds of dollars.
Really?
Yeah.
And how many farmers would you say are doing this kind of breeding through a program like yours, through somebody like Premier Select Sires, versus doing it on farm themselves through their own herd management?
I would say a majority of them at this point. I mean, there are still bulls out there, but there's downsides. There's dangerous, you know, they're dangerous. You don't know their background genetically. So I think between using a technician service like Select Sires or doing it in-house, you know, you learn how to do it yourself. I'd say there's a good amount. Yeah.
Right at the beginning of the show, we were talking about the dairy sector, and I know that you do both dairy and beef cattle, but in the dairy sector, for example, still about 80% of Vermont dairy farms have under 200 head. So we're talking about small farms still in Vermont. And one of the things that you do is actually work with small farms, and not every breeding service does that, right? I mean, in terms of economy of scale, it's easier to work with, you know, somebody who's got thousands of head.
Well, yeah, if you look at, you know, it's more more profitable to show up at one dairy and breed 50 head compared to driving around to breed one cow here and there.
Yeah, so why do you still do what you do?
We have technicians. We're able to make it work economically. We value those customers. We said at the beginning we're farmer-owned co-op. So that's kind of the direction that, you know, that our board members have taken us. It's still worth it for us to be out there and delivering the best genetics.
Yeah, well, I appreciate you talking with us and helping me understand a little bit more about the process
and how
it works. That's Andrew Sutton, Northeast Technician Supervisor for Premier Select Sires. It is a farmer-owned co-op, and technicians around here can do on-farm visits in New York and Vermont. And we'll turn now to a different kind of breeding program, I suppose you could say. Beekeeping is, in a sense, sort of a breeding program in some ways, and Hugh Gibson is a member of the Vermont Beekeepers Association. Hugh, nice to have you with us.
Yeah, thank you for allowing me to be here today.
Well, it's always nice to talk bees, and, you know, maybe I should disclose I am a beekeeper myself. We keep bees in our family, so, you know, particular personal interest in this subject matter
that's,
as well.
That's great. You can do some fact-checking on my answers.
I just plan to learn.
Okay.
The Vermont Beekeepers Association held its annual winter meeting yesterday here at the farm show. About how many, 150 people or so showed up?
Yes, it was an excellent turnout, about 150 people. That's pretty close to the high number. So, you know, we were very impressed with that.
Do you think it was just the right weather and timing for to get a high number, or do you think there's more interest in beekeeping than in the past?
Well, it's certainly a combination. The weather helps for people to travel a long ways. It's also a work day for many people, so we're always impressed that people take the day off from work to attend the meeting. In addition, there is a big increase, seems yearly, about raising bees or interest in bees.
Yeah, one of the things that you said is that there's actually more diversity in the types of people who are thinking about keeping bees. And what are you thinking about when you say that? You mean like urban versus rural, or, you know, what do you see in sort of diversity in beekeeping?
I think it's come a long ways from the traditional stereotypical picture people have of an old guy like me in the backyard in a veil to people who are more involved in the environment, climate change, the pressures on bees, and they're more interested in helping raise pollinators, where before, if an individual wanted to do beekeeping, their main thought in their head was honey in the jar. How much honey can I get? And we have more and more people coming in not interested as a primary honey production, but helping to pollinators. And beekeeping always has a mysterious interest for people. And so it's a combination of factors now. So it's good. It's growing across a large spectrum of people.
So as the interest is growing, one of the things that you see, though, are issues with the pollen that they're able to get, where they're able to forage. You know, we can sometimes also see problems that bees are getting diseases or getting pesticides that might kill a hive. So are we seeing more interest but also a decline in either productivity or the availability of the appropriate flowers?
I think there's been very variable weather patterns. You know, the new norm type question comes up, and I think any animal or insect is slow to respond to quick changes, so that I think that has brought about some issues. You know, locally looking at Vermont, I think we've been fairly stable. If we have severely hot summers, you know, a drought, it would be a problem. Bees, all animals, insects need water foremost. And then if it's hotter, we have shorter blooming seasons. The flowers are there less time. So it seems like today it's you have to be quite open in what you're going to investigate if you're going to be a beekeeper, where before when I started, you could just put the hive out in the backyard and come back later and gather honey, and that's not being a stretch. So today is totally different. It's full management to be successful.
How often do you open up your hives?
Well, it varies with season, but during, you know, the high points of spring, summer, once a week. Once a week, and if there's a problem, I'll go back and handle that. But
and how many hives do you have?
I currently have five, and I actually live right at Five Corners in Essex Junction. So,
you're really right local to the farm show.
Very local here, and you know, quite connected to a tight community, and I've had no problems at all. In fact, my neighbors love it for pollination of the gardens and flowers and so on. So.
Well, thanks for talking bees with us. As I said, always something interesting to talk about, and maybe puts us in mind of summertime and springtime and flowers, which is a nice thing at the end of January.
Well, thank you very much.
That's Hugh Gibson, a member of the Vermont Beekeepers Association. And before we go today, we're going to turn to some of the younger people who are here at the farm show and working hard today, as it turns out. We have three students with us from the Natural Resource Management Program at the Hannaford Career Center in Middlebury, Rosa Stewart, Eben Clifford, and Sam Klingensmith. They're all here for the FFA, the Future Farmers of America competition and meeting today, where students from around the state have been thinking about whether they might want to run for statewide office with the FFA, doing competitions in dairy and forestry programs, and even in some cases going on a scavenger hunt around the farm show. Rosa Stewart, let me ask you first, what FFA is, for those who are less familiar with Future Farmers of America, and what are you doing in the program?
Okay, so FFA, which stands for Future Farmers of America, is a national organization that helps develop leadership qualities into our nation's future agricultural leaders. So I'm currently a Middlebury officer. I'm the reporter, and so that means I help get word out to the community what we do and how we can help promote agricultural education.
So do you get extra credit for doing this today then? Seems like a perfect thing for your role.
I mean, no, not really, but I really enjoy it, and it's fun to be out here and participate.
Why? What made you want to join FFA?
I guess I like being out there and communicating with people. Like I said, it helps develop leadership qualities, so that's always a good thing to have. And just being a part of this community, the agriculture community, you meet some great people, and there's great experiences in it.
Well, thank you for explaining a little bit about FFA, and let me turn to Eben Clifford now. Eben, can you take me through a little bit about what you've been doing in the forestry competition? I walked through and I saw like 20 stumps that I assume you have to identify what kind of tree they are, and I mean, that was like among 50 items, some of which included things like beetles that I assume you have to identify, or some pine needles that maybe you're trying to make sure that you know the right one. So you tell me what the competition was like.
Well, we had a bunch of twigs out on a table, and we had some pests there out in the woods, and we had the stumps that you saw, and we have to go out and we have to identify them. We have to know like the characteristics so we can identify them. I am very familiar in this topic because my dad is actually a forester, so I've been around this since I was born, pretty much. So I'm very comfortable with it. I'm not a very good teacher, but I help the other students in the class as best as I can. But
well, that sounds like maybe you are a very good teacher.
Well, yeah.
Rosa is behind you right now saying, yes, you are a very good teacher. And I understand you actually came in second in the winter forestry competition?
Yes, I did.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
So what does that mean? Do you then go on? That's a component in the national program, right, if you want to go on to a national competition?
I'm not sure, actually.
So you're just doing it for the love of IDing different...
Yeah.
Interesting. Well, congratulations on coming in second, and thanks for talking with us briefly. Sam Klingensmith is with us as well. Can you talk about something else? So we've talked a little bit about the forestry program, but through this program that you're working on in Middlebury, you're also doing a maple metering project. What's that all about?
We're developing a way to measure sap flow directly out of the trees in the sugar woods.
Meaning what? So directly measure sap flow as opposed to what's been doing. What are people doing now if they're sugaring?
There's no way to directly measure like the flow rate of liquid in the sugar woods because the lines are not all the way full, so you can't put a normal flow rate in, like they would use like in.
Like you couldn't put a normal meter.
Yeah, normal
because,
meter.
Because why? Because the flow rate changes over time?
No, because the lines are only partway full and you need to maintain the vacuum.
Got it. So a normal meter wouldn't work because of that. So what is yours? How does yours work differently?
The patent's not done, so we can't disclose that.
Oh, no. But this is a big enough deal that you're actually getting some interest in it and, you know, people are coming to you.
Yeah,
you're
got
traveling to Washington.
We got a grant from MIT, Lemelso MIT, for $10,000 to help develop this project, so it's really moving forward.
And so why are you interested in this? I mean, are you a sugar? Is this something that you want to do for a career?
Actually, no. I just got involved with the class last year, and they asked me if I want to be part of this program, and it seemed I like developing things, I like fixing things, and I like figuring out problems, so I was like, this is the way to go. And then I learned about sugaring through this class last year, and I thought this might be a way to go, at least for this year. So,
have you ever actually made maple syrup yourself?
With the class last year, we have our own sugar woods and our own sugar house and all this stuff. So we made it last year.
How do you think this then helps you as you think ahead to what you might do after high school?
It's been giving me a lot of great like skills to like, work with people and figure out problems. And just like when you run into stuff that you don't know you're going to run into when you're developing something like this. So there's always going to be a problem to fix, regardless of how far you get. So it helps you deal with that.
Well, it's cool to hear about that. Sam Klingensmith. We also heard from Eben Clifford and Rosa Stewart, three students from the Natural Resource Management Program at the Hannaford Career Center in Middlebury. Thanks to all three of you for being on the program today and helping us wrap up our hour at the Farm Show. Thanks.
Thank you.